pull up a chair. I want to tell you about an airplane that should never have worked. An airplane the experts laughed at, an airplane built out of wood, of all things. In the middle of the most mechanized war the world had ever seen, when every other combatant was pouring aluminum and steel into the sky by the ton. They called it the Wooden Wonder, the Timber Terror. The men who flew her just called her the Mossy. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Taildragger, and this is the hangar where we pull the old birds out into the sunlight and remember why they mattered. Today we're going to talk about the de Havilland Mosquito, and I promise you by the time we're done you're going to love this airplane the way I do. Now before we get into it, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on today. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up the ladder. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story, and friends, this airplane we're talking about today, she's got a story worth a whole shelf of coins. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's go back. Picture England in 1938. The war hasn't started yet, but everybody can smell it coming, and over at the de Havilland Company, a fellow named Geoffrey de Havilland has an idea that just about everybody in a position of authority thinks is crazy. The thinking at the time went like this. A bomber needs to defend itself, so you load it up with gun turrets. Turrets in the nose, turrets in the tail, turrets on the top and belly. And every one of those turrets needs a gunner, and every gunner needs ammunition, an armor plate, and all of that weighs a tremendous amount. So your bomber gets heavy and slow, and it lumbers along, and it needs fighter escort anyway. De Havilland looked at all that and said, "What if we did the opposite? What if we built a bomber with no guns at all? No turrets, no gunners, nothing. Strip all that weight right off. And instead, we make it so fast that nothing in the sky can catch it. You don't need to shoot back at a fighter if the fighter can never get close enough to shoot at you." Now here's where it gets interesting to make it that fast and that light. He wasn't going to build it out of metal. He was going to build it out of wood. Plywood, spruce, and balsa, layers of it, molded and glued, and the establishment, the air ministry, the serious men with the serious mustaches, they thought this was ridiculous. Wood? In 1940? A wooden airplane going to war against Messerschmitts? They wanted turrets, they wanted guns for a long stretch there. The whole project got no official support at all. De Havilland built the thing largely on his own dime, in secret, out in a country house at a place called Salisbury Hall, where they set up shop in a hangar disguise, so the enemy reconnaissance wouldn't spot what they were up to. But let me tell you why wood was actually a stroke of genius, and not just stubbornness. England in wartime needed aluminum for everything. Every ounce of it was spoken for. But wood. Wood England had, and more than that, working with wood didn't require aircraft factories full of skilled metalworkers, it required cabinet makers, furniture builders, piano makers, companies that built wardrobes and staircases and coffins could be turned loose building airplane parts. The whole cottage industry of British woodworking got folded into the war effort. Furniture shops all over the country were suddenly turning out fuselage sections and wing spars. The construction itself was beautiful. The fuselage was built in two halves, like a canoe, molded over big concrete forms. A sandwich of plywood on the outside, then a core of balsa wood, then plywood again on the inside, light, strong, and smooth as glass. They'd fit all the control cables and wiring into each half while it was still open and easy to reach. Then glue the two halves together around it. Try wiring an airplane that way today, and your avionics shop would weep with joy. And what did they hang on this wooden marvel? Two Rolls-Royce Merlin engines. The same magnificent V12 that powered the Spitfire and the Mustang. Two of them, one on each wing, throbbing that unmistakable Merlin song. I want you to close your eyes for a second and imagine standing on a grass field at dawn as a mosquito starts up. First one Merlin catches, coughs a little cloud of blue smoke, and settles into that deep growl. Then the second one lights off, and the whole airframe, being wood, it kind of resonates, it sings. Pilot said the Mossy had a sound all her own. Not the hard mechanical clatter of a metal ship, but something warmer, almost alive. She first flew in November of 1940. And when they took her up and started running the speed trials, jaws hit the floor. This wooden bomber, this thing the experts had sneered at, was faster than the Spitfire, faster than nearly every fighter in the sky. On either side, she could do better than 380 miles an hour up high, in an era when the fighters chasing her topped out right about the same, and they had to climb up to her altitude first, and by the time they got there, she was long gone. That was the whole idea, and it worked even better than de Havilland had dreamed. Suddenly those serious men with the serious mustaches weren't laughing anymore. They wanted mosquitoes. They wanted all the mosquitoes they could get. And here's the thing that makes this airplane so special, because she was fast and light and honest to fly, they discovered she could do just about any job you asked of her, You want a bomber? She'll carry a load of bombs to Berlin and be home for breakfast. In fact, they eventually squeezed a 4,000-pound bomb, a great fat thing they nicknamed the Cookie, right into her belly. A wooden airplane hauling the same bomb load is a much bigger four-engine heavy, and doing it at nearly twice the speed. You want a night fighter? Fit her nose with radar and cannon, and she'll hunt German bombers in the dark over England. You want reconnaissance? Strip out the guns, load her with cameras, and she'll fly over occupied Europe, photograph anything you like, and outrun anybody who objects. You want a pathfinder to mark targets for the heavy bombers? She'll do that. You want to attack shipping, hunt submarines, escort strikes, carry a big cannon in the nose to bust up trains and armored vehicles? She'll do all of it. They even used her to haul cargo and important passengers and to run precious ball bearings out of neutral Sweden on high-speed dashes across enemy-held airspace, sometimes with a passenger tucked into the bomb bay. One airplane, every job, that's a rare thing in aviation. Then or now. Now let me tell you about the raids, because this is where the Mosquito went from being a clever idea to being a legend. The Mossy became famous for what they called precision raids, low-level, pinpoint strikes. Instead of 1,000 heavy bombers pounding a whole city from 20,000 feet, you'd send a handful of Mosquitoes screaming in right down on the deck below the treetops to hit one specific building. There was a raid on a Gestapo headquarters. There was the famous strike where Mosquitoes went in to breach the walls of a prison at a place called Amiens in an operation called Jericho, to help resistance prisoners escape before they could be executed. Flying so low, the crews could see the faces of people on the ground, threading between buildings, putting a bomb through a specific wall at better than 250 miles an hour. That takes airmanship of a kind that just gives me chills. No computers, no smart bombs, just a man's eyes, his hands, his feet, and his nerve, and that beautiful wooden airplane doing exactly what he asked. There's a story I love. There was a German leader, Hermann Göring, who ran the whole German Air Force, and he was said to have absolutely lost his temper about the Mosquito. The story goes that he raged about how the British could take some wood and some glue, build an airplane that every German factory with all their aluminum couldn't match for speed, and then fly it right over Berlin in broad daylight and thumb their nose at him. And in fact, the Mosquitoes did exactly that. They ran daylight nuisance raids on Berlin timed to interrupt big Nazi speeches, just to embarrass them, knowing nothing could catch them. Can you imagine the sheer nerve of that? Building your war winner out of the same stuff they build furniture out of, and using it to humiliate the enemy over his own capital city. Now, I have to be honest with you, the way an old pilot ought to be honest, because loving an airplane doesn't mean pretending she was perfect. That wooden construction had a soft side, the glues they had in those days. The airplane was designed for the cool, damp climate of England. When they took Mosquitoes out to the hot, humid, tropical parts of the world, the heat and moisture could get into the wood and the glue and cause problems. There were cases of structural trouble in the tropics that had to be chased down and fixed. Wood is a living material in a way aluminum is not. It breathes, it moves, it needs care. And she wasn't the easiest airplane to fly either. Two big Merlins meant a lot of power, and if you lost one on takeoff, that asymmetric thrust could get away from a pilot who wasn't sharp on the rudder. She'd swing on you, she demanded respect, the way a thoroughbred does. But a pilot who knew her, who had her figured out, would tell you there was no finer airplane in the sky. They flew her, they trusted her, and an awful lot of them came home in her precisely because she was so fast that the enemy never got a shot. They built somewhere near 7,700 of them, in Britain, in Canada, and in Australia. She served long after the war ended, doing survey work and target towing and all sorts of odd jobs well into the 1950s and beyond. And here's the part that hurts a little, because she was made of wood. Time has been cruel to the Mosquito. A metal warbird can sit out in a field for 50 years and a determined crew can still bring her back. But wood rots. Wood gets eaten by bugs and swelled by rain and dried out by the sun. So of all those thousands built, the number left in the world today is heartbreakingly small, and for a long, long stretch there wasn't a single Mosquito flying anywhere on Earth. Now here's where it gets interesting, and where I get to send you off happy. Because a bunch of stubborn, wonderful people refuse to let that stand. Restoration teams, especially some brilliant craftsmen in New Zealand who relearned the old ways of molding plywood fuselages, they went and built Mosquitoes flying again. From original plans, original methods, sourcing the right timber, laying up the wood the way de Havilland's furniture makers did it 80-some years ago. And today, there are once again a precious few Mosquitoes back in the air, singing that twin Merlin song at air shows, where grown pilots stand at the fence with their mouths open and their eyes wet. If you ever get the chance to hear one, to actually stand there while a Mosquito goes overhead, you do it. You drive all night if you have to. because you're hearing something that came within an inch of vanishing from the world forever. You're hearing furniture glue and spruce and two Rolls-Royce hearts, all working together. Exactly the way one stubborn man promised they would when everybody told him he was a fool. That's the lesson of the mosquito, if you want one. Sometimes the crazy idea, the one everybody laughs at, the one built out of the wrong material by the wrong people in the wrong shop, turns out to be exactly right. Aviation has always rewarded the person willing to look at how everyone else does it and quietly ask, what if we did the opposite? My thanks to the good folks at the de Havilland Aircraft Museum out at Salisbury Hall, where this whole story began, and to the historians and restorers who've kept the Mossy's record straight and her airframes flying. You can find us anytime over at radiohangar.com. This is Tail Dragger. Keep the blue side up, and go find yourself an airplane to love.